Welcome to season 5 of Underserved. This is episode 51. We have as our guest today Bob Hammond, CTO of Choreograph. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us this week, and welcome to the show.
Thank you much. My pleasure. Good to see you.
So way back in the day, in like high school years, I know you lived in the Boston area, but with your dad being a sales executive, did you really live in 11 different places and attend 4 different high schools?
I did indeed. Yeah, my father worked for Union Carbide back in the day. So as he got promoted up through the ranks, he got transferred to different regions in the country, pretty much mid-US to the East Coast. But yeah, 11 different places, 4 different high schools. Actually, I was born in Allentown, Pennsylvania, but never lived there. Direct out of that, went down to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So I was a Cajun boy for 6 years or so. And then funny enough, moved from Baton Rouge to Chicago. So almost overnight, I had to lose my accent and become a Chicago guy from there. But yeah, so 4 different high schools. That was probably the toughest part, to be honest with you. So the way I actually dealt with it is I became a sports guy. I became a jock, right? So being able to integrate myself into friends of the school and stuff through sports. So played football, baseball, hockey, that sort of stuff. Never really a good basketball player ever. Probably too short at the end of the day, but yeah, use sports to kind of integrate myself in. And now it's kind of interesting because I ended up moving after I was married out of school and stuff, moved up to New Hampshire, and I've been pretty much in the same town for 30 years, 35 years. So that's the settle down of my life, I guess.
All right. So in between, you went to college at UConn, right? University of Connecticut?
Yeah, I did. First couple of years, I went to Central Connecticut out of school, right? You know, one of the other down, well, for me anyway, I always was one of those folks that had to study really hard. It didn't come naturally to me. So, and then I was a jock playing baseball and football and stuff in high school. So didn't stellar on the grade side, right? And started out at Central Connecticut State and kind of came into my own there and then transferred over to UConn and finished up not with an engineering degree, but with a biology degree with a minor in chemistry. I had aspirations of being a doctor early on, but that didn't quite make it through. So came out of school as a biology guy at the very beginning of all this.
So then what do you do for your first job?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So I became a lab technician in Dover, New Hampshire, and that actually caused me to move from Connecticut up to New Hampshire as I worked out of Dover in a company that actually did in vitro fertilizations for pigs, of all things. So we developed what we call extenders, sperm extenders. So essentially collecting samples, putting those samples into extenders, which allowed you to actually freeze those samples and ship them across the country. And then they used those to actually inseminate hogs across the country as well, and worked as a lab technician in that, and then doing in vitro fertilization techniques on cows and other stuff as well as some research projects and stuff. And I did that for about 2 years or so.
Huh. I got to imagine that's a lot of effort just to kind of crossbreed hogs. Is it to them like extra delicious or?
Yeah, I guess so. So I think they have the males, of course, and there's a select breed of males that allows you to either have piglets that grow up quick or good quality and that sort of stuff. So fairly prized. So they would use this transport medium to collect the sperm samples, preserve those, freeze those, ship those across the country for basically fertilization in the farms themselves.
Well, as a barbecue guy, I see these like Berkshire and Heritage Duroc breeds. So I bet they're the great grandsons of those guys.
They are indeed. They are indeed. Yep.
All right. So that company, I think you've said they went under and sold and were at a crossroads.
They did. They did. Luckily enough for me, right? I got laid off 2 years into that and tried to figure out what I wanted to do, you know, post that. So I went through the whole determination trying to figure out whether I wanted to go back to school and get a PhD and do biology as a profession, or if I wanted to do something a little bit different in my life. One of the nice things, or one of the things I kind of remember back in the day as an undergraduate, and even in high school and stuff, I used to dabble in computers in various ways. Not heavily, really. I wouldn't call myself geeking out on computers per se. I was much more caught up in the sports and the jock side of the house. But when I took some undergraduate courses at UConn in computer science and computer engineering and programming and that sort of stuff, back in the day, it was PL1 and PLC and those types of things on deck equipment. I was always very good at that. Came naturally to me. very, very easy, finished my projects really early, ended up doing and helping others and tutoring others and helping them with their projects as well. So it was something I was always interested in. So I decided to go back to school at the University of New Hampshire for computer engineering and did a little bit of a mix between hardware engineering and software engineering. So everything from motherboard design, chip design, to everything from boot proms to interrupt service routines to application development, those sorts of things as well. So a bit of a mix between hardware and software. And I didn't go after another degree. I just basically took as many courses as I could in the undergrad departments. And then what I used to do is walk into the graduate departments that theoretically I couldn't get into and sat in, took a test, and then presented myself to the professor saying, I'd really like you to accept me into those classes. So basically kind of almost bullied my way into the classes as well and took pretty much all of the undergrad as well as the graduate courses and then came out of that. And luckily enough, got a break into CompuGraphics as an engineer, as a software engineer.
That's really cool. In a previous episode of Underserved, I told a story about how I had maxed out my tuition reimbursement at EDS and then took a third night course and, you know, barged my way in, and that ended up changing my career trajectory.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny how these things happen.
Very cool. So you learn enough there to get a job in the industry. What's your first job like working in the computer industry?
I did. I actually got a break. So I got a position at CompuGraphics, which was a company that did typesetting technology. So if you remember way back in the day, you may not remember this, depends on how old you are, of course. Way back in the day, they had typesetters where they had the lead-based type and you would assemble it into the typeface and then you'd print the pages, ink and print kind of stuff as well. Well, CompuGraphics produced basically computerized versions of that where you could type it into a word processor, you can pick fonts. This is the early days of Word, as it were, pick fonts and stuff. And then from there, you could print out very high quality output or prints of that, which now you can translate that into typographical representation and then print pages of newspapers and that sort of stuff as well. So I started with CompuGraphics way back. I was an embedded engineer. So I did a lot of things like operating systems, configuration systems, memory management systems, configurations and calibration systems, that sort of stuff. It was all assembly code, all embedded on 6509 Z80SIO types of embedded processors back in the day. And yeah, that's how I started out. It was pretty cool.
And then where do you end up in the late 90s when the dot-com is booming?
Yeah, interesting. So I kind of worked my way through CompuGraphics. I worked at a company called Apollo Computer. So if you're a little older and have been around for a little while, Apollo was one of the original CAD/CAM 3D, 2D high-end kind of processor. They were the first ones that did a million polygons way back in the day. So worked my way there. We competed against Sun Microsystems and a bunch of other DEC systems and that sort of stuff as well. And then we sold that to HP back in the early 80s. And then as part of HP, I had the coolness of transitioning into product management as well. So I kind of got an MBA on my feet as part of HP and still did engineering as well. And then the first dot-com was at CMGI. So I worked with David Weatherall and CMGI doing a product called Planet Direct. And they kind of renamed themselves MyWay.com after a little while as well. But it was a competitor against Yahoo. So it was a news feed, news source, kind of a Yahoo-ish type of implementation. So that was the first time that I kind of moved out of Unix, physical 2D, 3D kind of computer world and moved into the internet. So that was, gosh, 95, I believe, when I first started that.
Okay. And do you stay there through the whole boom and bust or?
The whole thing, right? So I kind of rode along with CMGI. We had a great time building a pretty scalable website over the time. So ran engineering, technical operations, deployment. Of course, it was all physical infrastructure back in those days. There was no cloud infrastructure. It was all physical. And then I moved into content distribution on Mirror Image. Mirror Image was a very interesting one. So we started it out pretty much in the basement in 98. And we did content distribution, distributed application services, distributed storage services, that sort of stuff, very much like Akamai, for instance, back in the day. And then ended up growing that company as part of the dot-com to about 450 people doing multi-millions of dollars of revenue across that. And the unfortunate part is as the dot-com bubble went down, we went down on the backside of that as well. I'm one of those very loyal types as well. So I stayed with Mirror Image for almost 8 years. So 3 or 4 years after the dot-com bust, I stayed with them as well, kind of rode the hurdle down, rebuilt the organization, kind of re-architected ourselves, built ourselves back up again, and then decided to step off and start a new venture after that. But it was quite the ride where, you know, we went from a four-person company to a company that was valued in the billions, if you can believe it, and then over the side went down to essentially nothing, tore that company back down to 75 people, built it back up again, and then stepped off.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Yeah, I know a few people who rode that wave all the way into the beach, picked
all
up pieces.
All the way into the beach. Yeah, we pretty much did as well. Kind of rode it right into the beach, but then built ourselves back out again.
And where did you go after that?
I went to a company called Maven Networks. So that's a Boston-based firm. We did where the original version was a white label video player that you downloaded to your desktop, but ultimately migrated from that to a video-based client server implementation embedded into that. So pre-roll, post-roll, interstitial ad development, video on demand, insertion. So frameless video services, that sort of stuff. So we were the ones that basically allowed websites to play video back within their website itself and then insert advertisements into that. It was a General Catalyst company back in the day.
That was all prior to YouTube, right?
All prior to YouTube.
Wow.
Yep, all prior. In fact, we actually worked on some of the initial implementation and designs of Hulu that was out of some of the stuff that we did back in the early days.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And then I think you ended up managing some of the broadcast.com people as part of that.
Yeah. So what I ended up doing was we sold Maven Networks to Yahoo. And when I went into Yahoo, one of the first things they did is asked me to run the Richardson, Texas operations, which is the old broadcast.com guys that sold to Yahoo before that. So we really focused on video ingestion, transcoding, storage, video playback, CDN, mobile-based transcoding, also mobile-based video delivery as well. That was a great one, to be honest, because the folks that I was able to work with were really great out of Richardson, Texas, really great engineering organization, technical operations organization. And we re-implemented a lot of that stack, including not only the transcoding facilities in the playback facilities, but also re-implemented all of the content distribution or video distribution facilities as part of that as well, and stood that whole thing back up again. It was a really great experience and great group of people.
Now, after that, did you decide to go back to a startup or another big company?
No, went back to a startup again. So went back to a company called JumpTap. So that was another General Catalyst company out of Boston. So they actually recruited me in. This fellow, George Bell, was the CEO. He was a newly established CEO that came in and ran that company. They were one of the first programmatic mobile-based DSPs, demand-side platforms, on the advertisement side. And that was honestly one of the best experiences that I had in all of my career, really. It was coming in, working for George, a bunch of other folks there that were really, really good, really excellent, actually. And we took that company when we first started to do programmatic from a relatively small demand-side platform delivering basically performance-oriented advertisements into a variety of customers out there, and then added brand delivery as well as scaling that company up to millions of transactions per second across that network. So really great experience.
I had a great experience with them as well. I was figuring out how to make mobile apps at the time, had an Android, developed this app called Gong. It's pretty simple. Had a gong on it. You press it, it would make a gong noise because a guy I worked with would always refer to of any situation was just a mess. He'd say, this place is a gong show. So we would play it. Just for fun, I took Millennial Media's SDK and implemented it. And it was really cool. Like you could say, all right, use these demographics, push ads here. You guys decide what the most lucrative ad is, drop it in there for me. And if someone clicks on it, I get paid. The Gong made a few bucks here and there, but then my wife said, well, why don't you make one for the Jersey Shore? I probably shouldn't admit my wife and I used to watch that all the time. So I made this little soundboard where you could press the characters and play some of their catchphrases. And that one was much more popular. I think we got 50,000 downloads in the first month. And you guys sent me a check for $300. And I was like, oh my God.
Which is great.
Imagine if I had 10 of these.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly, Viacom sent me a cease and desist and said, sorry, that's a property of MTV Networks. I tried to get them to do a licensing deal, but they're like, we like to build our own apps. So that came to an end.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the greatest part about JumpTap was not only the people that I worked with, but also the technology that I worked with as well. back in the day, it was still physical infrastructure stuff as well, but it was a very large scale. So it was global in nature, high transactional types of technologies throughputs. And you mentioned a little bit about how we decide what's the best ad for you. That was the coolest part about it, right? Because we would get a what we call an RTB request, right? Which is a real-time request for an ad placement. And we essentially had 100 milliseconds to not only capture that ad, decide on the ad, the best place in that, what we call a spot, which is the position on the pub page itself to put the ad, but to actually go through a bunch of data science to figure out not only what the optimal and or the probability of a click or a conversion on that ad for that spot, right? And that's based off of back of data science and audiences and all the rest of the stuff that go as part of that. But the technology that we produce, not only the real-time capacity around it, but just the data science around that to actually decide what the best ad is for the probability of action against that ad was just really, really cool stuff.
It was like a smart auction you had to do in a fraction of a second.
Fraction of a second, absolutely. And the biggest challenge of that whole thing is programmatic was just starting. So RTB was just coming on. We did something called mediation prior to that, which was a what we call pre-buy. So we would pre-buy on a pub, a particular spot. And so we kind of knew how much traffic was coming our way and how much we would have to scale and how much capacity we would have to put in place. But when programmatic RTB came along, there was no such thing as pre-buy anymore. It just kind of came at you, right? So you needed to scale with the advent of programmatic and the basically the rocket effect of advertisements across the internet taking off. So we grew that from maybe 50,000 requests per second to millions of requests per second across a 2.5 or 3 year kind of thing. So it was all about how do you build scalable systems that either auto scaled or allowed you to add additional capacity really quick? And then how would you build your systems in such a way that if you had out of the world spikes that come into your thing, that it just doesn't knock you over? So not only was it was an operational challenge, an architectural and infrastructure challenge, but then the data science behind some of the stuff that we did was just really, really cool stuff.
Now, were you guys running all your own data centers, or is AWS a thing at the time? Or
wasn't even a thing yet. No, we were still in our own data centers. In fact, we sold JumpTap to Millennial, and then we started to take the physical data centers there from the Millennial side and the JumpTap side and started to bring those together into one thing that was all physical data centers. I think the world of cloud had started, but there was no way that the cloud architecture could handle the transactions that we were doing. Plus also the data in and the data out that was going across those systems. It just wasn't possible at the time.
Now, I imagine with millions of transactions a second, you're trying to keep as much as you can in memory. What's the tech stack look like that you guys are working with there?
Yeah, never touch disk. Everything is memory, right, at the end of the day. So you have basically RTB servers that sit up front that captures the request. That actually, as that request comes in, it gets repurposed into a packet of data that goes into the decision logic. We use Solr at the time because Solr is a very, very fast search engine that allows us to index into the campaigns themselves. And based on the targetable characteristics that came in on the request, we could pull the series of ads that best match those characteristics super fast. And then we did a basically an internal auction that said, let's say of those 10 ads that match the characteristics of the request, which one of those ads has the highest probability of an actual conversion or action against that? And then you had to mix in, where were you with what we call flighting, right? How much have you spent against the ad already that day? Is it in rotation? What's the priority? All those sorts of things. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you pop out with one campaign with a bid price against it. And that bid price can be different depending on how aggressive you wanted to win the auction. And then that went back to the SSP, which is the supply side platform. And then they produce the auction there to actually pick which of the variety of requests that came in for that RTB request do they want to actually serve back to the pub at the end of the day. So not only do you have to do it in 100 milliseconds, you had to win the auction at the same time. So there was a little bit of a balance between how do you actually determine the bid against that request such that if you want to, you can actually win that request back at the SSP side.
Thank you so much for joining this Zoom panel interview for our software development position. My apologies for having to reschedule it 7 times.
Hey, no worries. Ready to get this underway.
Let me introduce the panel members from our company. First is...
Whoever that is, can you please mute?
Sorry, that was me. Mailman's here.
Hey, you guys hear me? Can you see me? My kid is playing Fortnite and my bandwidth is sapped.
Hey, sorry, I was on mute. Hi, this is Connor Walton.
Can everyone who is not talking please mute yourself?
Sorry, so where were we?
Yeah, so the main reason I joined was to let you know that I accepted a job offer from your competitor this morning. Sorry, your process just took too long. Laters.
Does this drill sound all too familiar to you? If so, you should call Syrinx. Syrinx helps you complete your projects on time and on budget. So stop the Zoom calls and start shipping code today. Call us at 888-579-7469, option 1, or email us at sales@syrinx.com. That's sales@syrinx.com.
So all this stuff's ripping around in memory. I got to imagine at some frequency or when there's downtime, then you are taking giant chunks of memory.
You're in
to
trouble.
Disk.
You're in trouble. So I used to have a monitor right above my desk, right? That had all of the monitors on it that showed me exactly where things were within the system, right? Up front, in the middle, and the decision logic and the delivery, all that sort of stuff. Things like dwell time, queue sizes, response times, all that sort of stuff as well. And you could see it coming. If you can have a problem, you can see it coming, right? But you're right. If you drop requests or you go offline, you don't make any money, right? So that's the interesting and scariest part of running a DSP or an SSP is because you're in the money transaction. So if you go down, you're in trouble. So that in many ways has influenced my operational life the most because even now, inside of the stuff that I'm working on today, which is not in line with the monetary transaction flow of an ad request, but we have services that surround that. Even now, even though if I go down for a particular reason in the technology that I'm dealing with today, it doesn't cost me any money. I still run my organizations in exactly the same way where we're hair on fire. If something goes down, we immediately jump on it and fix it and bring it back online. Even though necessarily it's not going to impact you, but that's just kind of the mental kind of way that we work and what we do.
And then does this stuff all hit a queue and eventually, you know, somewhere some other machine does write it to disk so you can report on it and do stuff like that?
Yeah. So on the backside of it, we always, especially, well, we had what we call a win request that came back to us. So if we responded to a request and we won that request and that impression actually happened, two things. One, we got the win request that came back to us from the SSP, plus also we got the impression tracker that came back to us as well from the ad that actually was presented on the page itself. We recorded that, right? Because you need to record that for analytics and reporting and what we call flighting services as well, because you only want to spend so much money, right, at the end of the day. And without getting too much into it, there's a whole thing, cost per click and cost per action and all sorts of analytical things that you track in the backside of the house. But yeah, it's all through pixels and all through HTTP requests and logging of that stuff.
So I think that company you end up selling to AOL?
We did. So we started with JumpTap. We sold that to Millennial. We combined JumpTap and Millennial into a new entity as well, and then sold that to AOL. Now, the AOL one was more interesting because, of course, they already have a well-defined organization and tech stack behind the DSPs, SSPs, and basically a well-built-out environment on the ad side of the house. So what I did as I went into AOL is they asked me to run the infrastructure that I already knew, which was the JumpTap and Millennial infrastructure. And the first thing that I did is I repositioned everybody that worked for me into the right areas within AOL because making sure that you report into the right entities with AOL made sure that the technology itself penetrated into the AOL world. So basically, a lot of people looked at me and said, why are you doing what you're doing? Because you're basically giving away everything. You're disassociating yourself and moving your teams to other entities. But that's exactly what I really wanted to do, because then I knew that those groups would be good. They'd have a home. The technology that we worked on JumpTap and Millennial could find its way into the AOL infrastructure itself. And those teams and those people would be good to go. I kind of stepped back, ran the infrastructure both on the JumpTap and Millennial side, And anytime that there was any problems, of course, I knew exactly who to call. So I'd make those calls if we had any problems, but it was, quite honestly, I got bored pretty quick. So about 6 months into it, I decided to leave AOL.
Yeah, you definitely did your team a solid by making sure they were well entrenched and the technology was entrenched in the mothership, because if you hang out there as your own entity, a lot of times, if you know the wind blows the wrong way, bad quarter, whatever, boom, everything's cut.
And you know, if you look back, that's what happened to us at Maven Networks as well. So when we sold Maven into Yahoo, we had about 6 or 9 months of, let's call it good times, right? Built, added new feature functionality, a lot of press, a lot of good things as well. But when times get a little bit tough, organizations entrench on what they know and they go back to their core, what we used to call O&O, own and operated, right? And unfortunately, they shut down the Maven Network stuff because it got kind of tough inside of Yahoo. I didn't want that to happen to this group. I wanted to make sure that the technology and the people and the teams progressed. So one of the first things I did right off the bat was to try to accelerate and move them away from me and get them entrenched, you know, into individual groups inside of AOL. And it worked out well. There's still folks that I know that still are inside of AOL, having a great time, new technologies. A lot of the folks come back out of it again. It's great because I get to meet up with them again. And I've even hired some of them back in again. So, you know, it's a very small community. You know, we all know each other. So staying tight with these folks is very important.
Yeah, when we were part of a consulting company in the late 90s called Web Technology Partners, we got bought by Monster.com in June of 2000. And it was a heavy emphasis from our ownership to make sure that people were kind of entrenched in an interesting area that had longevity. And there's still a few folks that are there 21 years later.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you get bored there after you do make sure that all your folks have a home. What do you do after that?
Yeah. So part of when I was at JumpTap, we licensed a technology from 24/7. And 24/7 was one of the old early ad-focused technology organizations. And there was a woman named Cole Pangas, who is the chief revenue officer there. And we bought all of this technology and services through her as part of 24/7. 24/7 ultimately was bought by WPP and was integrated into Zaxis. Zaxis is an agency inside of WPP, which is a pure programmatic agency with a lot of technology inside of that company. Actually, it was interesting. I was on LinkedIn one day and it flowed past me because I was connected to her and I saw that she was looking for a CTO, which was the first Zaxis-based CTO that they've hired. So I just kind of reached out to her and pinged her and magic happened and ended up being Zaxis's first CTO, which was really pretty awesome because Zaxis is unless you know WPP and the entities inside of WPP, many folks look at Zaxis as a programmatic agency, you know, works with customers on the advertisement side, on the pub side, and worked with them to deliver advertisements across a programmatic link. But if you look inside Zaxis really close, they're a heavy technology outfit. And they did things like what we call Copilot, which is a predictive bid. Basically, the technology I talked about at JumpTap, which is the decision process behind what campaign and how to bid on that campaign as part of that DSP, we called it Copilot, which was the Zaxis technology that we built. But then we also built another technology called Turbine, which was an audience platform, which basically ingests what we call learning data, which is basically information about what the people are doing on pub sites across the globe. There's learning data, campaign data, exchange data, first-party advertisement data, third-party data from things like American Express, Polk, Axiom, Datalogix, Experian, those types of things. And we built audiences from that data set and then did data science and segmentation and scoring and lookalike, clustering, and ultimately activated custom audiences into DSPs for advertisements so that they would have an audience base in those DSPs to deliver campaigns across. Pretty cool stuff. And started there building that technology now almost 6 years ago now with Zaxis.
And so how does that lead to where you are now?
Yeah, so it's been quite the ride. So I was in Zaxis for about 9 months and they asked us to move. And if you don't understand WPP, WPP is basically a conglomerate of companies, hundreds of companies that actually constitute WPP. And each one of those has their own technology inside of them. So Turbine at the time was a technology that was only consumed and used by Zaxis. WPP wanted more people to use that technology outside of just Zaxis. So they asked us to move from Zaxis into Group M, and we rebranded turbine into what we call M Platform. So that was the technology and services that we produced. And that was a great ride as well. So we moved it from a single customer, which was really focused on Zaxxas, to multiple customers, which was part of the Group M family. So this is the agencies there, Mediacom, Mindshare, Wavemaker, MEC back in the day, and grew that technology from a single source up to globally, and then recasted that into a much, much larger customer base across Group M.
So how does Group M become Choreograph, or give birth to Choreograph, if you will?
Yeah. So we spent about 2 years actually building up the technology around M Platform. We also call it M Insights as well, which is the audience portion of that. Again, as I mentioned before, this is data ingestion, profile building, audience building, custom audience building looks like. Basically, we're building custom audiences for activations inside of DSPs. So we spent about 2 years or so inside of Group M adding new feature functionality, capacity, new services as part of requirements of our customers inside of Group M. And then we decided to increase our product set by starting to consolidate other technology organizations inside of Group M. So there was a company called 260, which was an analytical and data arm of Essence that merged in with us. There was Mindshare, or Wavemaker OS from the Wavemaker guys, which is a campaign planning group. We bought a company called Sandtable, which did simulation technologies. And then there was the Exchange Lab as well, which did analytical technologies, and merged all these together into an entity called Group M Data and Technology. So then we did audience technologies, campaign planning, activation, and analytical and visualization technologies as well. So then from that, we merged in the Wunderman Thompson data organization, which brought in some really, really great audience and data characteristics into the world, put those two groups together, and that's how Choreograph was born.
Now, as your role there as CTO, are you looking a lot at acquisitions? Are you looking at kind of the product roadmap and how the team's doing implementing it? What takes up a lot of your time, and where's your strategic focus these days?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So as we brought in the Wunderman Thompson data technology base itself, there was really nice overlap and between some of the technologies that we did on M Platform, which is what we call grafting technologies, audience technologies, as well as audience technologies that came in as part of Wunderman Thompson. As we brought those two together, what we're really focusing on now is how do we actually consolidate and orchestrate that into a single identity platform. So the idea is we would bring in audiences off of the identity network that was built out by Wunderman Thompson and the identity networks that were brought in from the M Platform side, and build a new foundation of identity, which combined the two together from data ingestion, normalization, the building of the graph themselves.
So Bob, are there kind of themes or the same problem that you saw come up over and over in your career, maybe with respect to scalability or other items and challenges that you saw again and again?
Yeah, and that's an interesting area because if you're lucky enough to be successful, one of the issues that you end up running into is how do you actually stay ahead of the business? One of the things that used to, quite frankly, worry me or scare me or keep me up at night if somebody asked me that question, right? Is how do I actually stay ahead of a fast-growing business? So one of the best examples I had, I think, is back in the JumpTap days. So when we first started out, we were relatively small. We maybe had 50,000 requests per second, and over a couple of years grew that into the millions, or pretty close to millions anyway, back in the day. So the architectures that you build, and even the networks that you build in support of 50,000 look very different than when you're trying to support a million. So one of the things that we had to do is basically change the systems at the same time that they were executing. It's always a lot easier to build something greenfield at a scale that's larger than what you had before, but it's a whole nother thing when you try to change the tires on the airplane or change the engine on the airplane when you're trying to fly the thing. And I've run into that a number of times. You know, one of the focuses on JumpTap was to, especially in the programmatic space, was to listen to a huge amount of traffic and grow our ad deliveries as fast as we possibly could. And you wanted to make sure that the capacity that you're building within a DSP also always stayed ahead of the campaigns that you tried to deliver across that DSP. So we had to change the engine a few times inside of JumpTap and even inside of Millennial as well as things were scaling.
And is there any time that you saw someone branch out and do something outside the industry that kind of caught you by surprise?
So this is back at JumpTap again. We had a UI developer back in the day who is a very good UI developer. One day he came to me and resigned. And I kind of looked at him perplexed because we were pretty good friends and we were onto a good thing and he was doing some really great work and really enjoyed it, you know, that sort of stuff as well. Actually, it may not have been Maven Networks back in the day. But anyway, he basically changed his entire career. He produced what we call a monkey tool. And if you look online and you Google monkey tool, I think it'll come up. But it's a single tool that the original concept was a tool that looked like a monkey that had 20 different tools integrated into one handheld tool. And he started out that company in his basement and it got so popular that he ended up resigning, quitting, changing his career completely, and actually being very successful in a brand new business that had nothing to do with computers.
So I did a little searching and I did manage to find it. It's called the Zootility Pocket Monkey.
Yep.
Zootility. You can find them on Amazon and they have all sorts of different like 11-in-1 tools and it's pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It really is.
So for things that you built, I know that you have a hobby of training in order to fly a plane one day. So you've got quite a flight simulator set up, right?
Yeah, I did. So my father was an old military pilot in the Navy. And something that I always wanted to do was to fly an airplane. Of course, you know, like most of us, you're busy at school. And then right out of school, I got married and I ended up having kids. And I mean, that was an excuse per se, right? But it just, I had more things in my life that filled everything. And at the time, flying an airplane wasn't something that I really wanted to do at the particular time. But then about 2 years ago, my wife bought me a 2-hour introductory lesson to flying at a field, Hampton Airfield, which is just right down the road, as a Christmas present. It's kind of cool. So I went down, flew a couple of times. And to my amazement, actually, I flew the airplane for the first time I was in the airplane. Of course, the instructor was right there next to me. So got pretty serious after that, flew most every Fridays, got fairly proficient. I was starting to do cross countries as well, starting to think a little bit about my solo and studying for the exam and that sort of stuff as well. And then unfortunately, COVID hit and that basically freezed everything. And if you're a pilot, you'll know this, but if you're not, one of the things that is very important as a pilot is to stay current and stay proficient at what you do. And when you step away from something like flying an airplane, a lot of it is hand-eye coordination and being able to feel the airplane. And if you step away from it, you lose that very quickly. So basically, I lost a year and a half of training in that airplane because of COVID. And so I kind of decided instead of going back and retooling and redoing it again, especially now that I'm extremely busy at Choreograph, I decided to build a flight simulator in the house and do that. And that was just about the time where Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020 came out, which is, if you haven't seen it, it is super realistic. So what I ended up doing was building a flight simulator essentially from scratch, from individual pieces. It's got 3 monitors, surround, it's got yoke and throttle control and pitch control and all the rest of the stuff. And now I'm waiting for a lot of what we call the console, which is radios, communications, VOR, that sort of stuff to become integrated with the flight simulator as well. And I'll build that physical stack. And then you can even go to the next step where you're actually talking to real people that simulate ATC, which is the communications part of flying, which will basically do everything from, you know, setting up VFR to IFR to complete flight simulations as well. Hopefully, once I retire, whenever that is, that I'll have enough time to go back and do some real flying as well. And if I can stay proficient in the flight simulator side, hopefully I can step into that relatively quickly. And you'll be amazed at just how realistic it really is. So hopefully, you know, it'll all work out and I'll get back into an airplane one of these days.
So the software is Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020. On the hardware side, do you have like multiple monitors to simulate the windows on a Cessna 172?
Yep.
And do you have like a yoke and
all of that stuff
and all that?
Yep, all of that stuff. So I've got 3 monitors, a yoke, a trim, a throttle quadrant, as they call it there as well. And then also I've got a lot of the online things that you would strap to your knee, for instance, like ForeFlight, for instance, to track where you are, and navigation facilities and that sort of stuff as well. And then headsets and ATC connections also. So it's really realistic at the end of the day.
So ATC is air traffic control?
Air traffic control, yep.
So is that you simulating like, this is Whiskey Bravo 17 dropping to 1400 feet or whatever?
It is for sure. So right now, because a lot of those systems are not integrated in with Microsoft Flight Simulator 2020, I'm waiting for the physical infrastructure or the physical devices themselves, which is like navigation equipment and radio equipment, to be integrated in with the flight simulator. As soon as that happens, then I've got dials and knobs that I can actually turn myself. And then what I'll do is I'll switch from the simulated ATC, which is what I'm using now, to the real life simulated ATC. If you can believe it, there are services out there that do that as a company, do simulated ATC type of interactions with flight simulators.
Are they doing it automated, like speech recognition, or actual humans?
Live humans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat.
Yep. It's a whole industry that I had no idea existed out there.
Do you know any of the companies that do that sort of thing?
Gosh, they don't come to mind right off. I haven't looked at them for quite a while because I'm kind of waiting for the devices to get hooked up. But yeah, there is one that's fairly prominent. I can't remember the name. They mostly operate on the West Coast. So New Mexico West. But yeah, there's a couple of them out there today.
So Bob, thank you very much for joining us and helping us kick off season 5 of Underserved.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it. It was great talking to you.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.